Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. A suicide bomber killed 12 people in northern Cameroon Wednesday when he blew himself up at a mosque during morning prayers. Officials say the early morning attack occurred in a village near the border with Nigeria. So far, there's been no official claim of responsibility, but the incident took place in an area often targeted by the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram. World Economic Forum founder Klaus Schwab says the fusion of different technological advances will be a major focus at the forum's annual meeting next week in Davos. Lisa Schlein reports.
As part of the formal agenda, more than 300 sessions will deal with critical issues involving global security, the refugee and migration crisis, geopolitical tensions, climate change, sustainable development, and the global economy. Taking center stage will be an in-depth discussion about what Klaus Schwab, the founder of the World Economic Forum, calls the fourth industrial revolution. Schwab says the revolution is being driven by advances in artificial intelligence, robotics, autonomous vehicles, 3D printing, nanotechnology, and other areas of science. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe's spokesman declined to comment Wednesday on rumors that the 91-year-old leader had suffered a heart attack, saying a response to the latest speculation about his health was unnecessary. Spokesman George Sharamba's response to a text message sent by Reuters asking for an update on Mugabe's health. An online news site in Zimbabwe published a letter Tuesday by an anonymous author saying that Mugabe had collapsed. VOA News. A confidential UN memo to the Security Council warns that a proposed peacekeeping force for Burundi would be unable to quell large-scale violence in the African country. The memo sent by UN peacekeeping chief Hervé Ledesous advised council members last week to travel to Bujumbura for urgent talks on the crisis over President Pierre Nkurunziza's election to a third term. The document outlines three scenarios, including a continuation of the current level of violence, an escalation, and finally an all-out war with fighting along ethnic lines. The United States has confirmed that Iran released 10 U.S. Navy soldiers Wednesday, a day after they were detained when they drifted into Iranian territorial waters. A Pentagon statement said no indication that the 9 men and 1 woman were harmed while in Iranian custody. The Navy is investigating. Iran's Revolutionary Guard said earlier that the group had been released after the U.S. apologized for the intrusion into its territory. Germany has outlined plans to tighten deportation laws for foreigners in the wake of a series of attacks on hundreds of women in Cologne and other cities on New Year's Eve. Henry Widrow reports that there have been several revenge attacks against foreigners in Cologne.
Far-right supporters and football hooligans smashed shop windows and damaged cars in the eastern city of Leipzig in the early hours of Tuesday. The rampage began around the same time that 2,000 supporters of the anti-Islamic Pegida movement demonstrated nearby. Olaf Spermer was among the protesters. Spermer said what has really annoyed them in recent months is the whole situation regarding foreigners and how things have been handled. German Justice Minister Heiko Maas Tuesday outlined tougher deportation laws for anyone convicted of certain crimes, including sexual assault. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In his seventh and final State of the Union address, President Barack Obama touted his accomplishments and focused on his vision for the future in an optimistic speech that attempted to define his legacy as he enters his final year in office. He addressed a packed House of Representatives chamber Tuesday in the U.S. Capitol. In the opposition Republican response, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley criticized Mr. Obama's domestic policies for leaving a rising national debt, among others. More at voanews.com on the president's speech and any reaction. Pakistani police and hospital officials said a suicide bombing Wednesday at a polio vaccination center in southwestern Pakistan killed at least 14 people and wounded 23 others. The attack happened in Quetta. A spokesman for the Taliban claimed responsibility. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs is condemning the closure and destruction of a displaced persons camp in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The sudden development left several thousand people with no place to live.
That's Nick Long reporting from Goma in Eastern DRC. Details coming up.
Also, at least one suicide bomber has detonated at a mosque in northern Cameroon, killing at least 10 people. And Nigeria calls for an emergency meeting of OPEC as world oil prices continue to tumble.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, at least one suicide bomber has detonated at a mosque in northern Cameroon, killing at least 10 people and injuring at least a dozen more. Local officials reported the incident early today, saying the bomber was included in the death toll. The pre-dawn incident took place in the town of Kolofata, near the border with Nigeria. While there has been no official claim of responsibility yet, the incident bears striking resemblance to various Boko Haram attacks in the area. The Islamic extremist group has waged battle for an Islamic state in northeastern Nigeria for the past 6 years and has recently begun crossing over into Nigeria's neighbors to stage attacks. Cameroon is one of five nations, including Nigeria, to take part in an international coalition to defeat the group. The coalition is made up of troops from Nigeria, Niger, Chad, Cameroon, and Benin.
A confidential memo warns the UN Security Council not to send a peacekeeping force to Burundi. According to the French news agency, the memo says a peacekeeping force would not be able to stop large-scale violence. AFP says the memo was written by UN peacekeeping chief Hervé Ladasous last week. It quotes him as saying, a truly worst-case scenario will result in a scale of violence beyond the United Nations' capacity to protect. The memo goes on to say that United Nations peacekeeping is limited in its ability to address significant violence against civilians, even violence amounting to genocide. Hundreds of people have died in violence in Burundi since April. That's when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office. About 250,000 people have fled to neighboring countries. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports there were more violence today in Bujumbura. It says an army captain and a police brigadier who defected have been killed in a gunfight with security forces. Police identify them as Captain Idi Omar Bahinda and Brigadier Jean-Claude Niangabo. Police say they were traveling in a car in which weapons were found.
The UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs is condemning the closure and destruction of a displaced persons camp in eastern DRC. The sudden development left several thousand people with no place to live. Nick Long reports from Goma in eastern DRC.
OCHA spokesperson Nadia Berger says nearly 4,300 people were living at the Makoto camp, about 70 kilometers northwest of Goma in eastern Congo's North Kivu province.
The site was burned down. And the people had to move away and find shelter somewhere else. At the moment, we don't really know where they have gone. There's a team on their way to Makoto to monitor the situation.
Berger said the provincial authorities announced their decision to close the camp about a week ago on security grounds.
The provincial authorities told us is that the firearm was found in one of the huts, so they decided to close the camp because it's in contradiction with the civilian character of IDP side.
The head of OCHA in the DRC, Ryan Poulsen, called the camp closure a collective punishment imposed on vulnerable people. Berger says OCHA and other aid organizations tried to delay the closure, but without success.
Our reaction and the reaction of the humanitarian community is that, of course, we would have liked to have more time to prepare for that. We're not against the closure of the camps, but we want to do it in a proper manner so we have enough time to let the displaced person decide where they want to go.
North Kivu has been racked by violence between the government and various militia groups for years. There are estimated to be about 600,000 displaced people in the province, of whom about 35% live in displacement sites. Local authorities have called for camp closures since 2014, and five camps were closed last year. But aid workers say there needs to be more cooperation from the authorities in the search for long-term solutions for the displaced, including more efforts to give them access to land they can farm. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
The two losing candidates in the Central African Republic's elections. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 11 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. At least one suicide bomber has detonated at a mosque in northern Cameroon, killing at least 10 people. Since it would not be able to stop large-scale violence, a confidential memo warns the UN Security Council not to send a peacekeeping force to Burundi. And the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs is condemning the closure and destruction of a displaced persons camp in eastern DRC. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Nigeria has called for an emergency meeting of OPEC as world oil prices continue to tumble. An OPEC meeting could come in early March. AFP quotes Nigerian officials as saying they do not plan to cut oil production to try to boost prices. Cartel members have been reluctant to do so because they fear losing their market share. Most of Nigeria's export earnings come from oil, as does most of the government's funds.
President Barack Obama has threatened to block South Africa from sending agricultural products duty-free to the United States. South Africa usually exports more than $154 million worth of the products to the U.S. annually. The duty-free allowance falls under AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act. Mr. Obama gave South Africa until March 15th to strengthen what Pretoria calls technical difficulties. The U.S. wants South Africa to lift barriers on U.S. meat and poultry products. VOA's David Arnold talked with reporter Delia Robertson in Johannesburg about President Obama's decision to temporarily suspend South Africa's duty-free trade allowance.
I think that came as a bit of a surprise to the South Africans, but some sort of further explanation has come forth explaining that it's a procedural matter.
What are the kinds of products that South Africa wants to ship to the United States?
I think one of the biggest ones is citrus. At the moment, we have large citrus-producing farms in this country, and South Africa had hoped to continue sending citrus. And, of course, if it doesn't get the benefits under AGOA, it comes into direct competition with other suppliers such as Brazil.
And what is it about our poultry, pork, and beef products that is a problem for South African consumers or the government?
They were concerned about dumping of cheap products on South Africa because, as you know, the U.S. naturally is a much, much larger producer of these products, and South African producers would suffer as a consequence, particularly small producers who are emerging black farmers. The other concern was, particularly as far as poultry is concerned, were the health regulations that South Africa imposes on imported poultry, and they've had to lower the standards for this deal because the standards that are set in this country are the same as those required for importing to and from Europe. And the health requirements are higher, particularly as regards to salmonella.
Does this suggest that the U.S. health standards for consumption of poultry are lower than those in South Africa and Europe?
Yes, in fact, they are. The levels of salmonella allowed in poultry in the United States are fractionally higher than what is allowed in this country and in Europe.
Can you explain anything about the historically disadvantaged importers that are one of the subjects of these negotiations?
It's historically disadvantaged consumers, I think, more they're concerned with. One of the elements of this agreement is that the United States and South Africa will ensure that sellers in this country, in black communities, who are the historically disadvantaged communities because of apartheid, one of the elements of this agreement requires that those shop owners and business people get part of this product so that they then have a cheaper product that they can sell on to their consumers.
Any hope that it's going to be resolved anytime soon?
South Africa said today that it's pretty sure it can meet the deadline of 15th of March, and they said that they're working together with the U.S., various U.S. authorities, and with local importers and U.S. exporters to try and meet that deadline. Sometimes I think in these issues there's also an element of brinkmanship that goes on that have less to do with trade issues than what they have to do with geopolitics. Some people in this country have raised the possibility that the United States is digging its heels in on this and being particularly tough on South Africa on this issue because of South Africa's close relations with China and Russia.
That was reporter Delia Robertson in Johannesburg. She spoke with VOA's David Arnold.
The West Africa Ebola outbreak could officially be declared over tomorrow. That's when Liberia is expected to get the all clear that there have been no new Ebola cases over the past 42 days. The World Health Organization is scheduled to make the announcement in Geneva, a day earlier than had been originally planned. There were more than 28,000 Ebola cases over the past 2 years, mostly in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. More than 11,000 people died. Liberia was the hardest hit of the three countries with about 4,800 deaths. Its last two Ebola patients were discharged from the hospital on December 3rd.
Denmark's legislature will vote later this month on a controversial bill that would allow the government to seize cash and or other assets of migrants and refugees. The proposal has been condemned by the UN Refugee Agency and some rights groups. The AP says the bill would allow authorities to seize cash and other items worth more than $1,400. Wedding rings and other items of sentimental value would not be confiscated. Meanwhile, Greece says it will request the European Union's border patrol agency, Frontex, to help establish a route to deport any migrants and refugees who do not receive EU asylum. They would be returned to Turkey. On the other hand, Lebanon has begun forcing Syrian refugees to return home where they risk persecution or death. And Jordan has increasingly tightened its admission policy after keeping an open-door policy for Syria's refugees since 2011.
Germany has outlined plans to tighten deportation laws for foreigners in the wake of the series of attacks on hundreds of women in Cologne and other cities on New Year's Eve. Police say the attacks appear to have been carried out by groups of young migrant men. 19 suspects have so far been identified, all of them migrants. As Henry Ridgewell reports, there have been several revenge attacks against foreigners in Cologne.
Far-right supporters and football hooligans smashed shop windows and damaged cars in the eastern city of Leipzig in the early hours of Tuesday. The rampage began around the same time that 2,000 supporters of the anti-Islamic Pegida movement demonstrated nearby, carrying signs with slogans like Freedom for Germany. Olaf Spermer was among the protesters.
Also speziell die Sache, was uns in den letzten Wochen und Monaten.
Spermer said what has really annoyed them in recent months is the whole situation regarding foreigners and how things have been handled. He says he's not alone in how he feels and that many people think things will end in a very bad way. German Justice Minister Heiko Maas Tuesday outlined tougher deportation laws for anyone convicted of certain crimes, including sexual assault. Police have recorded more than 500 criminal complaints from New Year's Eve, almost half of which involved sexual assault. Andrea Mamone, an expert on the European far right at Royal Holloway, University of London, says anti-immigrant groups are exploiting the attacks for political gain.
Trying to spread this message, we told you. So we told you that it was unacceptable to have these people. We told you that it was a danger to have these people. We told you that they were coming from different traditions, different culture, and that they couldn't understand our values.
In a series of revenge attacks on foreigners in Cologne, 6 Pakistanis, 2 Syrians, and 3 men from Guinea were injured. German Chancellor Angela Merkel defended her policy of accepting over 1 million refugees Tuesday.
Wir wissen seit den schrecklichen Ereignissen in der Nacht von Köln.
She said Germans know that since the terrible events of that night in Cologne, for integration to work, society needs to be open. But she said the refugees also need to be willing to follow the country's rules and values. Cologne police have set up a 100-strong team to investigate the New Year's Eve attacks and are looking at exchanges on social media in the run-up to the night. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
World Economic Forum founder Klaus Schwab says the fusion of different technological advances are changing the world as never before. He said these advances will be a major focus at the forum's annual meeting next week in the Swiss Alpine village of Davos. Lisa Schlein reports from WEF headquarters in Geneva.
More than 2,500 leaders in the fields of business, government, academia, civil society, the media, and arts will meet to debate matters of major import in Davos. As part of the formal agenda, more than 300 sessions will deal with critical issues involving global security, the refugee and migration crisis, geopolitical tensions, climate change, sustainable development, and the global economy. Taking center stage will be an in-depth discussion about what Klaus Schwab, the founder of the World Economic Forum, calls the fourth industrial revolution. Schwab says the revolution is being driven by advances in artificial intelligence, robotics, autonomous vehicles, 3D printing, nanotechnology, and other areas of science. He says people today do not have the luxury of time that existed in previous industrial revolutions to adapt to the rapidly evolving technological advances.
This fourth revolution comes on us like a tsunami. The speed is not to be compared with the last revolutions. And the speed of this revolution is so fast that makes it difficult or even impossible for the political community to follow up with the necessary regulatory and legislative frameworks.
Schwab says robotics, with new innovations such as self-guided cars, will destroy employment and wipe out much of the middle class, a major pillar of democratic systems.
My fear is if we are not prepared and we have a concentration of jobs in the high level, more innovative areas, and in the low service areas, and this could lead to a new problem of social exclusion, which we absolutely have to avoid.
Schwab says governments must put the necessary regulatory systems in place now to tackle the problems he expects will be brought about by these changes. Failure to do that, he warns, will lead to social tension and conflicts in the future. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Started in 2014, West Africa experienced the largest Ebola outbreak in history. affecting countries outside the region and bringing the threat of global pandemic to the worldwide consciousness. But Ebola is not the only disease caused by microbes transferred between animals and humans. And as the global population continues to grow exponentially, along with demand for food, more threats arise. Jill Craig reports from Nairobi on the launch of a new program designed to help prevent and manage these diseases.
At a hotel in Nairobi on Tuesday, the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization and the U.S. Agency for International Development launched the East African component of FAO's Emerging Pandemic Threats, or EPT2 program, to help detect, prevent, and control new zoonotic diseases, meaning those which can be passed between animals and humans. Suvash Morzaria is the global coordinator of the EPT2 program at FAO. He says these diseases can be transmitted through the air or by touching infected fluids or materials.
Whatever the mode of transmission, even it could be transmitted by vectors, the point is that if these infectious diseases persist in our animal populations, then we have a constant risk of these diseases potentially becoming pandemic, means causing huge, huge outbreaks and morbidity and mortality in humans and in animals as well.
Ebola is only one of the zoonotic diseases. Others include HIV and AIDS, influenza, including those commonly known as avian flu and swine flu, as well as SARS, MERS-CoV, Marburg, and Nipah. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, an estimated 6 out of every 10 infectious diseases in humans is spread from animals, and the humans keep multiplying. The United Nations projects that the world's current population of 7.3 billion people will reach 9.7 billion in 2050. And this rapid increase in the number of people means that the demand for food will also rise.
Now, these production systems will change very rapidly to meet this demand. And it's possible that some very risky practices in the production of livestock might occur. And these risky practices might create an environment for evolution of new pathogens and spread.
Kenya's Director of Veterinary Services, Dr. Kisa Juma Ngeiwa, adds that these new pathogens can be spread even further in today's mobile society.
Let me use the H7N9 influenza, which was in China. That is a disease, one of the influenzas on live bird markets. Now, if you look at the airplanes, Kenya Airways, Ethiopian Airlines, and others, they are going to China and they're coming to Kenya every day. So because of that, there is a big vulnerability unless we put measures to be able to see and stop it from spreading.
And Morzaria says that everyone has a stake in the process.
Everybody's a threat. The virus doesn't distinguish between a poor and a rich person. It goes and infects and it kills that person if it's highly infectious and pathogenic. So I think that this is a global concern.
In October, USAID announced $87 million in new funding for the program. The money will be used to help governments and veterinary services better understand livestock systems, including the dangers of rapid growth, and to help conduct proactive surveillance, as well as identifying current and potential pathogens. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on the Voice of America. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama will deliver his final State of the Union address. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss his speech and his foreign policy agenda for Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa.
This is our moment. We are speaking out to end malaria.
This is DJ Drogba.
Malaria is preventable and treatable.
Sleep under an insecticide-treated mosquito net every night. Go to a health center at the first sign of fever for testing and appropriate treatment.
Join me. United, we can beat malaria.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. At least one suicide bomber has detonated at a mosque in northern Cameroon, killing at least 10 people. Since it would not be able to stop large-scale violence, a confidential memo warns the UN Security Council not to send a peacekeeping force to Burundi. And Nigeria calls for an emergency meeting of OPEC as world oil prices continue to tumble. Coming up, music from Ghana, and in our feature segment, a discussion by the Center for Security and Strategic Studies on issues that affect the youth in Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off in Ghana's capital.
Kim, let's kick off in Accra. That's where three candidates in next month's FIFA presidential election have lobbied for votes at the West Africa Football Union Zone B's General Assembly. Picking up the story, here's our friend in Accra, Kwabena Quicksilver Ofori.
The candidates, Prince Ali Al Hussein, Sheikh Salman bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa, and Gianni Infantino, addressed the media. Sheikh Salman bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa explained his plans.
President Blatter has been successful in introducing such programs to help the countries that are in need. And I think this has to continue as well. If I look at Asia, I think we focus on the countries that are in need for support. But Asia and Africa are more or less the same. When we look at the background of the countries, the culture, and even in football, I think there is a good understanding on what needs to be done. But other regions feel the same way as well. In Africa, football has flourished, and this region in particular. We all know that most of the teams that reach the World Cup are from West Africa. But again, we need to focus on the others that need the support as well. Because if you want to raise the level, we need to focus on all areas, not just a certain region.
At the Congress, President of the Ghana Football Association, Kwesi Nyantachi, retained his position as WAFU Zone B president. The Ghanaians secured four votes to beat Jibrila Hima Hamidu from Niger, who got three out of the seven total votes. The delegates from the seven WAFU Zone B member countries are Nigeria, Niger, Benin, Togo, Ivory Coast, Burkina Faso, and Ghana. Ghana's Kwesi Nyantachi will serve a new term as head of the sub-regional football body from 2016 to 2020. For the Sunny Side of Sports, Kwabena Ofori in Accra.
Thanks, Kwabena. Joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, controversy over the recent African Football Award ceremony in Abuja, Nigeria. How about some details?
Yes, Sonny. Yaya Toure, he's got so used to lifting that trophy, the CAF Footballer of the Year, that he found it very difficult to accept that for once he wasn't going to lift it. He has won it, Sonny, four consecutive times. That's a record. But this time it was Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, the Gabon and Borussia Dortmund striker, who struck gold. Aubameyang collected 143 votes, and those came from either national coaches or technical directors in the various members of CAF. Now, here's, Sonny, my first disappointment of this whole event. Only 43 of the 56 eligible countries actually voted. 13 did not. And I think that is nothing short of a disgrace. There was plenty of warning, and CAF have reiterated that they also sent out several reminders to national football associations to get those votes in. I mean, Sonny, realistically, it will probably take you all of a couple of minutes to decide who the African Footballer of the Year and the African-based Footballer of the Year were going to be. And I think it's a black mark. And, Sonny, I'm going to go further and name these countries. Angola, Benin, Congo-Brazzaville, Kenya, a big surprise to me, Central African Republic, Ethiopia, South Sudan, Eritrea, Sao Tome and Principe, Comores, Seychelles, Reunion, and Zanzibar. Those countries could not find a couple of minutes to decide who the African Footballer of the Year was. And as far as I'm concerned, Sonny, shame on them. Now, when you look into the voting, Sonny, it's bizarre, absolutely bizarre. 18 countries considered Aubameyang the top player, and they gave him 5 points. But 9 other countries didn't even consider him worthy of a place among the top 5. They gave him no points. And one that really disturbed me was Ghana. Ghana gave their 5 points to their homeboy, Andre Ayew. I've got no problem with that. But they gave no points whatsoever to either Aubameyang or Yaya Toure. Now, if those two players, Sonny, are not among the top 5 in Africa, well, I've just been watching the wrong game for the last 12 months. My reading of this, Sonny, is that Ghana decided not only were they going to boost Ayew's chances, but they were going to make sure that they did not give any votes to what were perceived to be his main challengers, Aubameyang and Toure. We also had a bizarre situation where the Sudanese voted number 1, Kareka. He is, of course, a Sudanese player. He's a very good player. But don't tell me for 1 second that he was a genuine contender to be the African Football of the Year. So what we have, Sonny, is very nationalistic attitude towards this voting. Now, I'm not quite sure what the best system is. Some people say, well, allow the public to vote. But let's take VOA as an example, Sonny. We have literally millions of listeners in Africa. And a huge number of those come from a couple of countries. And my worry would be that that immediately gives players from the countries where VOA are very strong a decided advantage. A simple example, let's say you had a Nigerian footballer and you had a Rwandan footballer. Now, the Rwandan footballer, it's a small country, so I think he's going to get a lot less votes. I've got a real worry about the public in that sense, that they're going to judge not so much on the abilities of the players, but on where exactly they come from. Then you come to this issue of the coaches and the technical directors, and I thought, well, this is the best solution because these guys surely know all about football. But then, Sonny, you look at Sudan, you look at the Algerians. The Algerians, they voted for an Algerian as number 1. So it seems to be a real problem here. There's a very nationalistic attitude towards voting. They're voting for their own person, I believe, rather than the best footballers. I don't think there's a shred of doubt, Sonny, that Aubameyang, Toure and Ayew were worthy top 3 contenders. You can argue for the next 12 months as to who should have been 1, 2 and 3, but they were very genuine contenders for the title. And the fact that Aubameyang, 9 countries totally ignored his amazing achievements at Borussia Dortmund, 27 goals in the first half of the season in all competitions. He's the hottest property in Europe, according to several news agencies. Several English clubs have been linked to him, including Manchester United, Arsenal and Liverpool. Are you really trying to tell me he didn't deserve a single vote? Anyway, Sonny, the drama exploded very quickly after the announcement. Yaya, who looked like he'd been hit by an express train when he was told he was runner-up, he said that he thought he should have won. His argument, Sonny, is that the judges did not take the African Cup of Nations seriously enough. Now, in the Cup of Nations, of course, Ivory Coast won the tournament. They won it under the captaincy of Yaya. Whereas Gabon went out in the first round, and obviously, because of that, Aubameyang made a very limited impression. But the counter-argument is that the highest level of football in the world is in the top European leagues. And here we're talking about England, Spain, Italy, France, and Germany. Aubameyang plays in Germany. He's playing at a very high level, and he's scoring basically a goal a game. He is a goal machine. But Yaya felt that the judges were looking too much at what was happening in Europe. And interestingly, you see, Yaya didn't have a particularly good year for Manchester City. So, yeah, he may have a point, up to a point, Sonny, but the general reaction on social media that I've watched from Africa is that he's a sore loser and he needs to grow up. Aubameyang, on the other hand, he made a pledge to his late grandfather. His grandfather died just last year, that one day he would play in Spain because his grandfather was a fantastic supporter of Real Madrid. And he told his grandfather, one day, Papa, I will play in Spain. Also interesting is the fact that we know that Barcelona have sent representatives to watch Borussia Dortmund with a specific eye on Aubameyang. So it's going to be a very interesting future. Aubameyang himself, I thought Sonny handled himself very well. He was very polite. He praised not only his own victory, but he also praised Yaya and Andre Ayew, who finished third. And then he got a hero's welcome in Gabon, remembering that he is the first Gabonese footballer to win the African Football of the Year. There are some huge expectations surrounding Aubameyang. I think the Gabonese nation expect that he's going to spearhead a major push towards winning the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations. Now, we've got to bear in mind Gabon are ranked 19th in Africa, and apart from Aubameyang, they don't really have any stars, so that's going to be a big ask. And, of course, the fact that he's now the African Footballer of the Year has brought extra attention, if it was needed, to him in the Bundesliga. I think every German defender will be on red alert to stop this man scoring even more goals.
And speaking of goals, David, 2015 African Footballer of the Year, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, is currently leading the Bundesliga in scoring with 18 goals from 17 matches played. Polish striker Robert Lewandowski of Bayern Munich is next with 15 goals. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a nice photo of Lionel Messi and Carly Lloyd, who on Monday were named the 2015 FIFA Male and Female Footballers of the Year. Both players are shown holding their trophies. Barcelona and Argentina superstar Messi won the FIFA Ballon d'Or award for a fifth time in 7 years, while Carly Lloyd won her first ever FIFA Women's Player of the Year award. The 33-year-old Lloyd becomes the third American to win the FIFA prize, following Mia Hamm and Abby Wambach. Wambach, the 2012 winner, played her last match for the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team last month. Abby retired as world football's all-time leading scorer, male or female, with 184 goals. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a discussion held by the Center for Security and Strategic Studies on issues that affect the youth in Africa. And next, we focus on a U.S.-based educator, Fiti Nkoba of Zimbabwe. But first, some music. Here is Kobe Maxwell of Ghana with Auruba.
You're a man. Biara, you're modern. Biara, you're high tech. With 21st century. Session, I you low tech. Jin and Jay Ati. So a friend with sister. Son with you Ati. So a friend with auntie. Son with you Ati. Grandma, who lady banke. Son with you Ati. Go fear, go die.
Well, the Center for Security and Strategic Studies recently held a discussion on some of the ways insecurity and violent movements affect African youth and youth-led solutions to these African challenges. VOA's Jackson Mvunganyi reports.
The Center for Security and Strategic Studies recently held a panel discussion examining what experts see as the impact of Africa's youth dividend and the possibilities of what can be gained as many of these countries fight their way to stable political systems and middle-income status. The panel explored the ways in which insecurity and violent movements affect African youths, but most importantly, what they see as youth-led solutions to what are essentially African challenges. Patrick Vandelaar is the National Director of the Student United for Reconstruction and Education in Liberia. He started his organization right after the civil war in his country.
We have been involved into the promotion of peace and unity among young people, leading them into developmental youth initiative, like a true civic education, reminding them that war is not an option, so that the mistakes that were made yesterday by our past generation cannot be repeated by my generation. I think we are more refined, and we need to demonstrate to the world that we are today's leader.
Mark Summers is the author of the new book, The Outcast Majority, War, Development, and Youth in Africa. He says that youth are essentially dominant players in whatever takes place on the continent. However, it is important for people to note that most young people resist the pressure to join violent movements, even though the majority often feel a sense of alienation from what they see as elite-driven political and economic systems.
Everything that goes on is youth are involved. The youth were involved dominating peace building as well as the violent activities. But I should point out that even in situations where youth can really get involved, have a chance to get involved in violence or in war, most resist. And so the big question we should be asking is, why are most youth so peaceful?
The panelists agree that failure by governments across the continent to address some of the unique challenges faced by the youth has created a situation where they have to turn to what would otherwise be unconventional means of survival. Matthew Bremen is the Africa Regional Director for International Youth Foundation. He says that there is a risk in the failure by governments to take advantage of this youth dividend.
That's from our vantage point. How do you use positive youth development and young people as this demographic dividend, as opposed to some of the stigmas attached to young people, that they're inexperienced, they can't do this, they can't do that, they have to wait their turn.
Vandelaar agrees. He says that such failure opens doors to elements in society that often exploit many of these young people.
When young people are not employed, as it is said in Africa, an adomai is the devil's workshop. People can easily manipulate them.
But Ritu Sharma, the author of the book Teach a Woman to Fish, says that she is more interested in looking at why so many of the youth in Africa, even as they are faced with high levels of poverty and inequality, are able to resist engaging in violent activity.
Well, 99% plus of young people in the world are nonviolent and not interested in violence. And we want to look at some of the positive outliers. So the question for me is not, why are youth so violent? The question is, why are so many youth nonviolent given the challenges that they face, particularly in Africa?
So the question really is, how do African countries use this demographic dividend to achieve the same progress that developed countries have had by going through what is known as a demographic transition, the kind of transition where largely rural societies transition to urban industrial societies? For Voice of America, I'm Jackson Funganyi.
U.S.-based educator Fiti Nkobo says growing up in Zimbabwe in the rural Soloso district prepared him for his journey to America. Nkobo is now a high school math teacher in the U.S. state of Maryland. He studied at the University of Zimbabwe, Oxford Brookes University in the United Kingdom, and George Washington University in the United States. Nkobo calls himself a rural boy at heart and feels privileged to influence his communities at home and abroad through teaching. He spoke with reporter Tatenda Gambo.
Of course, most of the time, obvious people expect we had behavior issues, and indeed we did have. But we also had students who were so interesting, who were fascinated with Africa, not in a negative way. Mm-hmm. There were kids who really wanted to learn more about Africa, just asking me the questions, and I was sharing certain pictures for them about Africa, and they were kind of appreciative. And of course, on the other end, it was the first time to meet students who are really, really challenging, and, you know, and they say their mind literally, you know, whatever is on in their mind, they would say it. So that was different from home.
Mm-hmm. And I think, as you're pointing out, a lot of African immigrants always talk about the difference in classroom structure from when they were growing up. You know, I grew up here in America, but I remember being in Zimbabwe, and when I first got here, you know, seeing how the kids interacted with the teachers, and it was very different in the sense of, you know, there wasn't that structure to say, okay, this is the teacher, you're the student. Can you talk about that?
I think one of the things, it comes from the educational philosophy. I think back home, sometimes teachers are demigods. And I know people won't like that statement, but the teacher knows everything. The teacher tells everyone what to do. And our whole system tends to be teacher-centered. Even when we do group work at home, the teacher probably will tell you, you sit with this one, you do this one. While that has an advantage of maintaining certain structure, it, however, does not allow students to grow, which is the difference here. Most of the things are student-oriented. Mm-hmm. So the teacher, most of the time, you facilitate, you tell them, today we are doing this. I know I've spoken about slope intercept, it's my favorite topic, and I happen to be teaching it when schools open. So the thing is, when you come in, yes, there may be that moment when I'm doing what is called direct instruction, the teacher teaching and saying the things, but just after for 10 minutes, you start to remove yourself and allow students to work as a group. And as you say, even this sitting arrangement, the teacher is not always in front. And when I was training to be a teacher here in America, I was told something interesting. I was told that a teacher can teach from anywhere in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And the eyes will follow you.
And since we've been talking, you brought up a good point that I think is wonderful, that you are a rural boy, and that no matter where you are in the world, you always go back to your rural upbringing. Can you talk about that and how, you know, that has impacted your work to this day?
Actually, the first time I remember was 1992. I finished grade 7 back home in the village. And I went to Bulawayo to start Form 1, which here in America would be like 8th grade.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the first thing that they said, they called us VK. And I've actually written a poem about that because I do write poems. And then VK meant Velekaya, mm-hmm. the one from the village, mm-hmm. you know. And to a certain point, I wanted to run away from my villageness. You know, it wasn't cool to be from Cholocho. And actually, I happened to be from Cholocho. And the teacher always said stuff about people from Cholocho. Oh, they do this. Oh, they steal. They are murderers. And you know, I wanted to be City. I wanted to talk about MacGyver, you know, wrestling, Shawn Michaels, you know. I didn't want to talk about Cholocho stuff. I mean, who does that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but as I became an adult, I started to realize how much blessed I am to have been brought up in the village. I've had the experience, and I remember this actually came strongly to me when I was in England, and I remember saying to myself, from Cholocha to Oxford, and I was talking to myself as I was walking in Oxford, and I said to myself, I should be proud. And I said to myself, why? I said, because Cholocha, the village, was able to prepare me for England.
That was U.S.-based educator Fiti Nkobo. He spoke with reporter Tatenda Gombo. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The end of the year 2015 brought with it encouraging news. For over 42 consecutive days, no new cases of the Ebola virus disease were reported in Guinea. This development marks the end of the original chain of transmission in the West African Ebola outbreak. Ebola is a viral hemorrhagic fever with average mortality rates ranging from 25 to 90%, depending on the specific strain. According to the World Health Organization, by the end of December 2015, this most recent outbreak resulted in 28,638 cases of the disease and 11,315 deaths across 10 countries, including the three hardest hit, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. The epidemic began in Guinea in December 2013 and soon spread, at first undetected, through Guinea and into neighboring Liberia and Sierra Leone. The World Health Organization's announcement of no new cases means that the three countries have successfully broken this deadly chain of transmission and are now recovering from the disease. This represents a significant milestone for Guinea, West Africa, and the international community, wrote Deputy Assistant to the U.S. President for Homeland Security, Amy Pope, in a recent blog post. Nonetheless, she wrote, West Africa is still at risk of reemergence of Ebola and other infectious disease threats. Reintroduction of the disease from survivors or animal sources is still possible, and amidst the chaos of the epidemic, other diseases, such as malaria, have continued to flourish. The fragile health systems in the affected countries were overwhelmed and need time and investment to recover. That is why the United States, along with other countries that aided the West African communities hardest hit by the epidemic, continue to work with Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia to develop long-term capacity to prevent, detect, and respond to infectious disease outbreaks. And since the economies of all three countries were hammered by the epidemic, we are helping them restore basic health services and assisting economic recovery. Addressing the unique needs of the most vulnerable members of society is also critical to restoring a positive development trajectory to the region. The U.S. government stands ready to help respond to any new cases of Ebola and continues to work with the governments of the affected countries and partners to sustain the gains made by building local capacity, wrote Ms. Pope. The United States is committed to standing with Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone now and into the future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
VOA News.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and